Welcome back to CSW's Free to Believe Spotlight Series podcast. I'm Sam Jackson-Reed, producer of this podcast, jumping in at the top of the episode just to remind you that this is part two of our conversation with Dr. Kataza Gondwe and with Sarah about women in Sudan. Part one came out last week, so do go back and listen to that before you jump into this episode, as this episode picks up right after where that one left off. And a reminder to get your questions into us. If you've been listening along over the last six episodes and something has popped up that we haven't answered, something you'd love to have more clarity on, or a question that you has been burning as you've listened, please do send them in to us. We're gathering up all these questions and we'll put them to our advocates in a special question and response episode in the not too distant future. You can do that via social media using the links in the description box below. And finally, please be aware that this episode comes with a content warning. Just like last episode, the conversation goes into the themes of sexual violence against women. So be aware of that up top before you begin to listen. I'll hand over to Kiri, Darren, Sarah, and Dr. Kataza for the rest of their conversation.
Something that you mentioned earlier, Dr. Kataza, about putting this context in the history of several conflicts that have happened in Sudan before this point, and also the experiences of women and the conflict-related sexual violence as something that has also predated this conflict and come forward. You mentioned in there as well, you alluded to, I think, minorities within that. Can you tell me a little bit more about, you know, even a minute, we've used this phrase before, crisis within a crisis. With mention to Darfur and perhaps other minoritized communities, can you sort of talk a little bit around that?
About the minorities, yes. Historically, as I said, this sexual violence, even in the midst of conflicts, has been a historical occurrence in every single one of Sudan's crises. When Sudan and South Sudan were one country, South Sudanese were the minority, a minority, and they were a visible minority in terms of ethnicity. So the war in South Sudan was characterized by slave raiding. There's no other word for it. They would enslave people. And the Janjaweed in particular would also rape South Sudanese women. So the use of rape as a weapon of war, as was mentioned earlier, to almost because the women are seen as bearing or the carriers of the honor of a people, or, you know, of a family, has been a historical occurrence in Sudan. So during the war with the South, it occurred. And then once the war with the South was dying down, it the same people who had actually attacked the people groups of South Sudan started to target the groups or people groups in Darfur where they were from themselves, who identified as African tribes. They identify as Arab tribes because you have this Arabization going on in Sudan. So they started then to attack the African tribes in Darfur. And that's when, you know, people began to pay more attention. I think sometimes because the war in the South was characterized, and it definitely was to a great extent, of Christians in the South were being attacked by the North. There was a reluctance, I think, internationally to recognize that aspect of the war. And therefore, a lot of the violations went unseen. With Darfur, where you have two Muslim ethnic groups, and one is attacking the other one on the basis of their Africanness as opposed to being Arabized, people began to recognize that tactic far more in that instance. and began to speak of rape being used as a weapon of war in Darfur or in Sudan, let's say. And but now, today, as people are seeing, you know, as the situation is really quite critical, and now we're seeing it being an atrocity crime being recognized as one in the way it's unfolding in the current crisis. People are still, you know, speaking much more about it and looking into it much more and thinking in terms of accountability for it much more. There's been a tendency for rape as weapon of war to be seen as almost like a byproduct of war. So it's not quite as important and not quite as vital in terms of, you know, of being addressed at the end of the war. But the way I feel that is shifting at the moment in because of the situation that we're seeing in Sudan, and hopefully the you know, the search for justice for victims of these horrors will be at the forefront of negotiations. If it's not right now, we will continue campaigning to ensure that it is, that it's not a secondary thing. You know, it doesn't come secondary to peacekeeping. It's essential to peacekeeping because, you know, if it's not addressed now and there's another crisis, it'll be even worse than what happened. So, yeah, it's the historical context that is, you know, it's just continued and continued and continued. And never once have we seen it being addressed. And by allowing it to continue without being addressed, it's actually contributed to the impunity that surrounds this violation. And people feel, okay, this is one thing I can get away with. And they see it more as almost like a trophy of war or a booty of war, so nobody has a problem with it kind of thing. But it has to be addressed in terms of accountability to bring it to an end.
Adding on to that as well, Dr. Kataza, is also looking at the legal context of how the Bashir regime used laws to control society into, in addition to this sort of Arabization and Islamization, and looking at the 1999 Penal Code that codified Sharia law in the criminal system, and that not only impacted non-Muslims, but Muslims who perhaps didn't share the same outlook as the government of the day. And it also had a negative impact on women. I talked about earlier the rules around reporting rape and those who had experienced rape and had reported it to the police in a criminal setting, sometimes finding themselves charged with adultery. But also there was the public indecency laws, which controlled through the religious police and religious courts the policing of women's bodies in public and in private. And we've seen this being used particularly to target female human rights defenders, those who spoke out at the time. But we were also have documented multiple cases where women from marginalized communities, often South Sudanese, women from the southern part of Sudan now, women from Darfur, those who worked in very economically vulnerable spaces, such as tea sellers, perhaps women who worked in homes as cleaners or house help, finding these public order laws used against them. And what was really interesting in the time between the war and after Bashir had been removed from power, but before the war had started, the Sudanese government at the time were very sensitive to listening to comments around freedom of religion or belief and very open to decriminalizing apostasy, for example, even though in practice we saw cases that showed the situation was otherwise. And looking at laws that restricted churches and Christian communities in particular. But when it came to laws around women, so they had several recommendations to adopt the International Covenant CEDAW on the elimination of discrimination against women, there was such reluctance to take forward anything that removed punitive elements of the legislation against women, aspects that sort of discriminated against women in sort of inheritance, in rules around marriage. There was a real reluctance to take those recommendations forward, and an enthusiasm in certain places to take forward FORB recommendations. And this is really when we talk about sort of intersectionality, when we're looking at conflict-related sexual violence and how we come out of conflict. It's so important that all of these issues are recognised and are sort of walk hand in hand, because they have an impact on all women in some way, shape, and form. But also when we see governments who have an enthusiasm to look at one area and protect one area to the exclusion of the other, that should always and is always an alarming bell that sounds for us. And whilst those perhaps who maybe were advocating for FORB didn't necessarily see the importance of looking at women's rights, we can now see that as this conflict has unfolded, as women have been so specifically targeted, the importance of these protections working hand in hand.
In many ways, it sounds from what both of you have said that the situation in Sudan is so critical, and what has gone on in terms of sexual violence and conflict has been so egregious that you know, it's not it almost puts it back on the agenda in a big way. It cannot be brushed aside as just a side, you know, something that happens alongside war, or something that you just expect in a conflict.
Hearing Sarah, you talk about the intersectionality of the issues, and to have the discernment that when the government starts to look at one issue at the exclusion of others, that that's an alarm bell. I thought that was really important to hear, and also reminds me of CSW's commitment to freedom of religion or belief for all, that a commitment to justice is a commitment to justice for all. And it's not just for one particular group, but it's for everyone. And so I appreciate the heartbeat there and the call for justice to not just be in the area of freedom of religion or belief, but to encompass the entire experience of human existence, though might focus in a particular area as an organization, that as work is done in areas like Sudan and others that are experiencing such incredible conflict, I appreciate the focus in bringing all of this into perspective.
Just to add one quick thought there. We've talked about how Sudan is such a high-profile conflict, but might not quite be getting the attention that we think it ought to have. And one of the things that we have advocated for and will continue to advocate for is for the inclusion of independent, genuine Sudanese civil society in the humanitarian spaces, in places like the UN Security Council or the UN Human Rights Council, where they can speak up on behalf of their own communities. But what we've also seen is, given the types of violations that are being reported in Sudan, is the lack of including Sudanese women in these spaces and in advocacy spaces to tell their own stories, to advocate for their own communities. And so the intersectionality is important in terms of the advocacy outcomes we're pushing for, but it's also important in who's in the room and who's able to tell the stories and how is that shaping public policy and those the power brokers and those who are in a position to affect change and influence the course of the war in Sudan. It's so important that Sudanese women are in those spaces and that they can speak fully to their history, but also to the experiences. And they have the solutions. They know how to implement various recommendations, what will work, what won't work in their context. And so it's so important that their voices are centered in those conversations as well.
These conversations, like many we've been having on Sudan, can be so heavy and hard to hear. It's so important because it is reality. I'm wondering what gives you hope in your work, in what you're seeing?
For me, the things that galvanizes me and just revives me every time is are the people themselves. They're resilient in the face of such horror. Sudanese women are just awesome. One of the first people that I made friends with, Sudanese women, was the first female Sudanese MP, member of parliament. And she was a member of parliament in 1967, but obliged to flee to the UK, under the al-Bashir regime. But the resilience and the determination to carry on and to speak on behalf of women and also for her country, that kind of just the dedication and the assurance that somehow things were going to get, were going to change. You can't help but be inspired by them, that despite what is happening to these women and to those that they love and, their families and their country, in fact, just watching, one's country being destroyed by two men whose egos just want to rule, even if it's going to be ruling over, just rubble. You cannot help but be inspired by their determination to make a difference, that this is not going to end like this. This is not the end of their story. They will be writing their story, and it's not going to end in the way that we're seeing right now. So I'd say that is what really keeps me, at least personally, going. Just the people themselves and their heroic struggle, and just being the privilege of being a part of that and doing whatever I can, even in a small way, to contribute towards that future goal that they have set for their own nation. I think that's it, really.
I would agree wholeheartedly with that, Kataza. I was reflecting on some feedback that we received from one of the trainings a little while ago, and there was a Sudanese woman who had been displaced from her home, and I think she said in her feedback that she felt frustrated at all of these things that are happening, and also even in her kind of local community where she now lives, seeing things that are wrong, seeing things that, somebody should, thinking that falls, or somebody should do something about this and somebody should do something about that, and almost sort of discounting herself as being the person who could do something about, the issues that she was seeing around her. And sort of by the end of this week together with some of the CSW team, said that actually I now know that I'm empowered and I have the power, the confidence, and the ability to do something about my situation, and almost to something like, I'm no longer a victim of circumstance, but I can do something. I can make something, even if it's small, I can do something that will improve the lives of somebody else. And I think given the context of the things that we've shared, it's so easy to be tempted into despair. But the resilience of that woman who said, actually, I'm not going to be a victim of my circumstance and I'm going to do something, is really inspiring and a real source of encouragement for us in our advocacy work to just do the one thing that's in front of us. Might not be able to fix everything, but we can do something.
That's inspiring, Sarah. I think any of us can relate to that what's the thing in front of us? What is it that we are called to do and how we can be involved? This podcast is a great starting point to begin to raise awareness. People, we can share it with friends and family so that awareness shared can create momentum. I have a theory that we can't all carry the weight of the world, but we are called to do something somewhere. We have to have a passion. We have to move into that so that we're not, as you said, tempted into despair.
I think what's come through all the podcasts, including this episode, is that the stories that we're hearing matter, that everyone's story matters. And I've found it particularly hopeful knowing that there are documenters out there faithfully logging in anticipation of the time when these stories will have their day to be heard and justice served for the victims. Thank you both for sharing your expertise today, for providing the historical context, for the present context that you provided as well. I think, as Darren said, do the one thing in front of us is one thing that we can all take forward with us. Thank you for listening. Thank you for staying with us. As we walk through this story, there'll be more to come. So please do stay with us. But I think above all, don't forget Sudan, something that was said in another episode by Mr. Rafat was to please don't forget about Sudan. It is chilling that something so, a conflict so high profile that everyone seems to know about, and yet it hasn't seemed to have broken through. But if we share it with each other and if we keep talking, we keep this on the agenda.
Well, I wanted to thank both of you women for the extraordinary work that you're doing in raising awareness, advocacy, keeping this on the agenda for decision makers in the UK, the UN, and globally. And it's such a privilege to sit down and have a conversation with you and hear your heart. And my hope and prayer is that those listening can catch that spark, that compassion, and that together, as we share the burden of what's happening in our awareness, can be moved to prayer, to learn more, to stay engaged, to advocate together, to support this work so that the women of Sudan are not forgotten, and that globally together we raise our voices on their behalf. Well, Kiri, one more time, I'm struck by the weight of the conversation around Sudan and also inspired by the work that's happening on this. And I feel a growing sense as I continue to learn throughout this series of wanting to continue to grow, learn more, and share with family and friends. It's given me a platform to be able to have conversations, to share the podcast as a tool. So I'm grateful that we can have these conversations, though they are so difficult.
Absolutely. Something that Sarah said about the Sudanese woman that inspired her, saying, you know, it's easy to be tempted into despair, but I now know I can do something about this. These are hard things to hear for anyone, including the people who work on these issues. But it's a privilege to walk this journey and to learn a bit more and to share it and to take the time to understand the history, the context, and how we got to where we are today. But I am encouraged, really, when I hear about the accountability, the clarity about what is needed for the accountability and how so many people are working towards that goal in the hopes that this will be the last time that this cycle of violence will end, and that this is the last time, and that Sudan will move on to a safer, more inclusive footing and peace. And so that's what we pray for. That's what we hope for.
And the accountability piece came into the forefront for me, the work of CSW, when I was recently in Colombia and seeing the importance of training. So our CSW leader from Mexico came down to Colombia to train indigenous Christians on the processes of how to properly document cases of abuses of freedom of religion or belief or human rights violations in general. And I was able to see firsthand how important that is, and such a behind the scenes type of action and training. And yet, as we sat with government officials and were able to present them with clear evidence-based situations that have happened, saw that it's much more powerful than if we just sat in a room and said, well, in this town, we heard that this happened 3 months ago. We were able to bring documentation that led to specific change. And this is what it reminds me of as we talk about Sudan and the need for documentation, for accountability, and eventually for justice. So I'm grateful that CSW is involved in that work, specifically in the area of freedom of religion or belief, but as Sarah so eloquently mentioned, the intersectionality of all of these issues as human rights issues and how they flow together and can't separate one from the other.
Absolutely. We've spoken a lot about CSW psychosocial training, quite rightly, but that documentation training that we do is also very important because it's the building block to that reporting that policymakers can rely on, that officials can refer to when they are assessing what they need to do. Some of that joined up action that Dr. Kataza mentioned, of universal jurisdiction, the kind of data that's going to underpin those measures is built on solid, accurate documentation. And, you know, it's a privilege to be involved in that work at CSW. And putting together these building blocks ultimately to see justice.
Thank you for listening to the CSW Free to Believe podcast. CSW is a Christian human rights organization advocating for freedom of religion or belief. As Christians, we stand with everyone facing injustice because of their religion or belief. Our work, including this podcast, exists because of the generosity of our supporters, just like you. If you're interested in finding out more or making a donation, go to csw.org.uk. You can help us grow this work and help it become a resource, highlighting and amplifying the voices of those who suffer as a result of their religion or belief by sharing it with your friends or by leaving a 5-star review in whichever podcast catcher you're currently listening to. The CSW Free to Believe Spotlight Series is hosted by Darren Adolpoker and Kiri Kankwende. It's produced by Sam Jackson Reed, and our theme music is by Sizgi, thanks to Artlist.io.